Welcome to the Other F Word Podcast with Morgan,
Sarah,
and Melissa,
where we talk about that dreaded word, failure. Join us as we explore the messy, tragic, funny, and inspiring stories that make us human. Hi, everybody. Remember, if you're enjoying the podcast, please rate and review us, and feel free to contact us at info@theotherfwordpodcast and share your stories of failures with us. We'd love to hear. We're extremely excited to have Mr. Jonathan Fields here. He runs the Good Life Project, which is an amazing podcast attached to it. I'm sure many of y'all have listened to it before. And great books, Uncertainty. He also has his latest book, How to Live a Good Life, The Three Bucket System. And, you know, he just affects people in their lives in a positive way and really helps people live the good life. And, you know, that's something we strive for here as well, Jonathan. You know, we talk about failure, but ultimately it's how do we get through failure to live a better life. And we really appreciate you coming on and sharing your good thoughts and your good energy and your good wisdom with us.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Of course. So can you tell us a little bit like what brought you to this work? What brought you to the Good Life Project and kind of that being your path?
So the short of it, I have the through line in my life is that I'm fiercely curious about the human condition, human potential, what allows us to live fully expressed, deeply meaningful, engaged lives. Have been since I was a kid, a little bit weird in that way. And I'm also a maker. I have always been filled with ideas and found ways to make them manifest in the world. That showed up early in the form of physical building, creating, making things with my hands, being an artist, a painter. Eventually morphed into being an entrepreneur and a founder and building a series of companies. And then eventually creating media, writing books, creating experiences, events, all sort of with around the intersection of the creative process, the process of making, and exploring human potential.
That's amazing. So I know this is a really big, loaded, extremely broad question, but what did you find in your research about what makes people happy and what is fulfilling and what kind of makes people their best self?
Yeah, it is a really big question, but maybe let's actually take a little piece of that, because I think the language that you offered is really interesting, which is what makes people happy was the first part of it. And I think that's the starting point for most of us. It certainly has been for me. What I found over the years is, there's certainly the canon of books and research now that are sort of out around happiness. It's pretty gigantic. And what I found over the years, though, is that very often happiness is the wrong question for most people. Happiness is a byproduct. It's not a direct pursuit. And it's a byproduct of the direct pursuit of things like purpose and meaning and deepening relationships. And when you pursue these other things in a more direct way, it creates the byproduct of this thing called happiness, however we might define it. And in fact, there's really fascinating research come out of the world of positive psych over the last 15 years or so that shows that the direct pursuit of trying to be happier very often actually leaves us less happy.
That's right. Yeah.
So it's an interesting question. So for me, when I think about it, you know, I start really diving in, and I'm a bit of a kind of esoteric. I'm kind of a geek, and I'm this weird mix of science and spirituality. So when I have an experience or an awakening or something happens in my life, I'm genuinely pretty discontent in just leaving it as, wow, that happened, that's cool, and enjoying it. I like to try and deconstruct it and figure out what just happened. Is there science underneath it? Is there a way to validate, build process, and replicate around it? So I spent a lot of time diving into a lot of published research, and especially around purpose and meaning and happiness, all this kind of strange umbrella term that they call subjective well-being, which kind of integrates everything. And the research is kind of interesting because it's all over the place. but for me, you know, the focus is really when I started to deepen into this and say, okay, so what are the core elements of a life well-lived? And I've just been incredibly blessed to spend a lot of years now also sitting at the feet of and learning from so many teachers from so many walks of life. And I started sort of turning on my pattern recognition engine. And it kept going back to these three things. And that's where sort of the idea of three buckets for me came up. You know, one is what I call, so if you think of a good life as being, or a happy life, or as a well-lived life, as being the optimization of three different buckets. One bucket is what I call vitality. And that's about optimizing your state of mind and body. And I kind of use them in a single sentence because it's pretty crystal clear these days that there is no separate mind and body. It is a seamless feedback mechanism. You know, when you are in psychological or emotional pain, you're very likely in physical pain and potentially illness and disease and vice versa. So that's one. The second element is connection. It's all about relationships. You know, and this is kind of interesting. The longest running study of human flourishing, the Grant study, the longest running curator of that study was once asked, well, of, you know, after tracking all these different people for about 80 years and nearly every metric in their life, is there any one thing that you see as being determinative of a life well lived? And his answer was love, full stop. And it really comes down to the depth of close relationships. So connection is a really important one between, you know, love, belonging, friendship, all the different expressions of it. And the third one to me is what I call contribution, meaningful contribution. And that's sort of what most people would label as their work in the world. And if you can really find a way to express the deepest parts of yourself, sort of your identity level self through the work that you do and have that be meaningful and have deep, you know, really beautiful, sustained relationships and find a way to optimize as much as you can your physical and mental well-being, that is a life well lived. That is, you know, and there are a lot of subcategories under that. But to me, like that's the big picture model for me.
Where does failure come into it for you? What do you, how do you talk about failure to your community?
Failure is everything. So one of the things, let me offer maybe a reframe. So to me, failure is what happens when reality does not meet expectation and you leave the outcome unexamined. To me, that is the only way to truly fail. You know, we go through life every day. I'm raising my hand. I stumble, I fumble, I set crazy, insane, you know, like aspirations and completely miss them nonstop, all day, every day. And if that happened all day, every day, and then I just kind of walked away and then I tried the next thing and the next thing and the next thing, and I never left any of those misses, examined, then to me, yeah, that is what I would call failure with a negative connotation, because I'm not moving forward. You know, if you don't examine it, then all you're doing is you're shooting randomly throughout your life. And maybe every once in a while you hit something where, you know, it's a good thing. But most of the time, you're just kind of fumbling in the dark. It's like you're living your life with the lights off.
Right.
Whereas if you're constantly running experiments and pretty regularly reality doesn't meet expectation, but then you pause and you do a bit of a postmortem and say, huh, well, that wasn't how I wanted it to end up, but this is the reality. I wonder what can I learn from this, you know, and what can I bring forward? What can I add to my bucket of wisdom and bring forward so that maybe if I try a different experiment or a new iteration of that, I have a better chance of having reality come closer to visions or aspirations or expectations. So that's kind of my reframe just on the word. And in terms of failure in the context of my own life or being willing to run constant experiments where I don't know what the outcome is going to be, that is life. You know, Joseph Campbell, you know, said, where you stumble, there lies your treasure. And it's all about a willingness to step out into the abyss. You know, to step out into that space where you have to make decisions, you have to invest yourself energetically, maybe resource-wise, you have to take risk, and you can't quantify the risk. You don't know if it's going to work out or if it's not going to work out, and the stakes are high, and that is a place where magic happens. Yeah. So to me, as long as I'm stepping out into that space on a regular basis, and if it doesn't work out, I'm sort of hitting pause and saying, huh, well, that's interesting. I wonder what happened here. What can I learn from it? you know, that I'm happy to live that life all day, every day. And in fact, I think if you don't, then you live in, you know, Theodore Roosevelt's gray twilight that defines neither victory nor defeat. Right. It's just you're living in the gray. So for me, I mean, there are macro examples of me going to that place and completely not getting what I wanted. There are like everyday examples where it's 6 o'clock at night and I open the freezer. I'm like, dude, there's no way that you should be taking out that container of ice cream and sucking it down. and then for the next 20 minutes, as I spoon it into my mouth, I'll be like, this is wrong. I shouldn't be doing this. This is not going to get me where I want to go. You know, there are small day-to-day things like that all the time. And then there are much bigger ones where, you know, I've had business failures. I have written things, published things, created media, run experiences and events where you plan as much as humanly possible. And you try and think about every permutation. You know, like I have in a very past life, I don't know if you guys have this in your sort of your background, I was a lawyer. Mm-hmm. And part of, you know, it's interesting what I've learned over the years is that, and this is my theory, is that most lawyers very often dream of becoming founders or entrepreneurs, and they make terrible founders and entrepreneurs. And one of the reasons is wrapped around this idea of failure. And the deeper sort of explanation of that is that as a lawyer, most of us are trained to look at an opportunity. And then our default is, okay, so this is an opportunity for a client. My job is to try and conceive everything that could possibly go wrong, every possible right. failure, every system, everything that can fail, and then protect against it. You know, so you spend your life living in the failure zone, and your job is to conceive of every way that this could go bad and then protect against it.
Right.
And then when you flip the switch and try and step into the mode of being the visionary, mm-hmm. where you have got to be, to a certain extent, delusionally optimistic, it's really brutal. It's very hard to make to flip that switch. So it's interesting to me, you know, coming from that background. But for me, law was actually a weird aberration. I was an entrepreneur long before I was a lawyer. So it was almost a strange thing for me to be in that mode, and actually really didn't enjoy it because I kind of liked the process of delusional optimism
and
creativity and making things. So I may have completely sidestepped your question.
No, I like it. I wonder,
just bring me back on course.
I wonder if, you know, but maybe some of that legal mind and kind of dissecting things helps you with that process, like, as you were saying, when you do fail, you have the ability to look in there and kind of process it and go through it and dissect it and figure out what you learned from it. What does that look like for you?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. So I think the training in law helped me. It gave me a framework for a sort of rational analysis of stuff. You know, I can do a SWOT on a lot of different things and figure things out and try and predict. But my sense is actually that because, you know, I was a lemonade stand kid, because I was the one who was sort of, I've been the creative kid from the time as far back as I can remember. And I always took risks and I always stumbled. The first half of my life when I did that, I've known for as long as possible that I'm wired to do that. Yes. It's just what I do. But at the same time, until probably the last decade or so, maybe 15 years, I have suffered greatly along the way, because stepping into that space of the unknown when the stakes are high and you're hoping something's going to happen is brutal. Most of us are not equipped psychologically to handle that. It kind of crushes us.
Yeah.
And that was actually the focus of my book, Uncertainty. Mm-hmm. You know, most of my books are answering a question for me. So I kind of said, okay, so if you look out in the world, whether it's art or business or parenting or whatever it may be, you'll always see this, you know, we hold up this tiny, like this really thin slice of whatever that world is. And we look at these people who seem to be the extreme outliers and seem to be able to take the big risks, create the huge bodies of work, the giant companies and all these different things. And they're okay. You know, that you're like, wow, they seem like they're like just, they want more and more of it and they can handle it and they're fine. And I got really curious that, you know, is that actually, are you born with that or not?
Right.
If not, is it trainable? And if it's trainable, then how?
Right.
And that was really the focus of that book, because I was suffering so much, you know, because I, I stepped into that space regularly because that's what you have to do for magic to happen. And I failed often. Mm-hmm. And probably in the early days, I wasn't looking at why I failed and trying to figure it out and get better at it. So I just suffered a lot.
Right. It's a really good point. If you're not having that self-awareness or curiosity, you can just kind of sit in the suffering.
Yeah.
You feel so alone.
And it's brutal.
Yeah, it's brutal. It is.
And you know, the thing is, I'm not alone in this feeling of I am here to make ideas manifest. You know, whether it's a company, a book, a video, illustrations, whatever it may be, there's so many people who are wired as what I would call a maker. In fact, you know, mm-hmm. with the recent work that we're doing, we're actually getting really fascinating broad data on the percentage of people who have this orientation. Yeah. And it's pretty big. So, you know, that means all these people, if they don't somehow equip themselves to be okay stepping into this space of high stakes uncertainty and living there long enough for, you know, to kind of push the first order of easy solutions out of the way, the second order of harder solutions but really not very good solutions out of the way, and last until you get to like that third generation of like, holy crap. Sorry, I don't know if I can say stuff
you
like that.
You could say okay. Even worse good. Words on this.
Pretty much everything flies yeah. on Good Life Friday.
Good. Good, same with us.
But, and plus I'm a New Yorker, so.
Perfect.
So, you know, to get to that place where you're really creating something extraordinary, you can't just settle for the things that come first and easy. Mm. You got to be in that space long enough for the really extraordinary, new, truly innovative ideas to emerge. And that takes time, and that takes a certain ability to be in that uncomfortable space long enough and to grapple with it long enough for the really good stuff to emerge. And, you know, so for me, I am not one of those people who's naturally wired to just be okay there. Very few people are. So it was a matter of figuring out, okay, so what do? If you're not one of those people, but you are wired, like you're kind of here to do that.
Right.
You know, do you just accept that you're going to suffer to do the thing that you're here to do? Or are there a series of practices or changes in an environment that you can create, put in place? And thankfully there are like things that you can do. So while I still, you know, get angsty in that place, I'm angsty on a level where it's sustainable for me. And in fact, if I don't feel that at all, it kind of tells me that the stakes are likely not high enough for this to be worth pursuing.
I think that that's an incredible point, because that angstiness is actually a clue that there's something really magical to learn. And I'm wondering, besides being wired in this specific way, wired as a maker, what was life like for you as a kid? Did you have parents that kind of inspired this and guided you? Because we often find that obviously it's kind of nature and nurture. It takes both to be able to push through failure or get to that deeper place. Can you share a little bit about?
Yeah. So I grew up in a house where my mom was a hippie potter and my dad was a professor. So I am kind of a split. I'm a mix of both of them. So my mom would vanish into a basement studio and just lose time. You know, she would lose hours, days, weeks behind the wheel, just throwing these extraordinary pieces with clay. And my dad would be upstairs in his office, either working on research. He was a professor. I'm talking about it in the past tense only because he retired. He's still quite alive and with us. But he had one job his entire life, and he taught psychology and he researched human learning. So he was, you know, just complete scientist. He was obsessed with complex problem solving. And so I was surrounded by these two people where one, you know, you go into this hyper creative space where, and what's interesting about pottery too, and what I saw with my mom is that, you know, you'll spend a solid chunk of time throwing this piece on the wheel. And then at the end of it, you'll realize it's not what you wanted it to be and just completely squash it down into right. a lump of clay and start over. And there was way more starting over than there was keeping. I became, you know, eventually I sort of stole a corner of that studio in the basement through an old door over a bunch of boxes of clay. And I had my grandfather's old set of paints and brushes and palettes, and I set up a little swing arm light and I started painting. And so I kind of knew from the beginning, I think, you know, probably in no small part from seeing my mom's process, that it's not about being perfect every time. Right. It's to a certain extent about staying in the game long enough so that, right, you know, you have enough iterations so that you can keep improving and getting better and better. But it wasn't easy, and still not easy for me. I threw away, you know, I would spend weeks painting something, and this was back in the day where album covers were about, you know, like the most badass art on the planet.
Right, yeah.
So I would paint those on jean jackets. I went through a lot of jean jackets.
Wow.
And then I would, you know, I'd spend weeks working on something, and then at the end I was like, you know, it's not what I had in my head. And I would just junk it. I would paint that, you know, paint the whole thing white and start over. And that was painful because I had really sort of perfectionist tendencies back then. And it kind of forces you to let go of that to a certain extent and say, hey, listen, like, this isn't so much, you know, I didn't use the words, this isn't failure back then. But what I had to tell myself is, okay, so I know in my head what I want this to be. And, but for some reason, I don't have the ability to actually express this in the world on a level that it represents what I see in my head.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope I'll get there. It's kind of funny because now as a writer, that same mindset is carried through. I'll read a book by a writer that I like, and I'll read a sentence. I just did this in the bookstore not too long ago, and I just started giggling. And my wife's like, why are you laughing? It's not a funny book. And I said, because I just read a sentence that is so beautifully crafted. And I know, like, I dream of being able to craft a sentence like that as a writer. I can't do it now. Like, maybe every once in a really long while I can come close to it. But I know it's probably going to take me another 10 years of writing and practice to be able to get to a place where I can write on that level consistently. And, you know, I think I'm further into life, and I've failed so many thousands of times now, and been able to sort of use that as a source of improvement and growth and developing competence and skill, that I'm kind of okay with that now. I'm like, you know what? I'm down for the 10 years of failure that it's going to take to get to the place where I can write four sentences on that level rather than a quarter of a sentence.
Well, that's an incredible insight. And in the art therapy world, we talk about focusing on the process over the product, and that if you can learn in the process and trust and not get attached to the product and the outcome, you can just have that rich insight and that ability to trust that the process could be long, right? 10 years. If you frame it that way, then you expect a lot of painful learning. You don't expect that perfection to come. And I think we often fall into that trap and then feel like failures.
Yeah. Well, especially these days, because I think technology is accelerating the pace of outcomes so much that, you know, we just have an expectation that all parts of life will deliver, you know, like the ultimate outcomes to us at the pace of a tweet or a text or a DM or, you know, like something on Snapchat.
So true.
And, yeah. So,
well,
so
I was going to just say, what I think is interesting, though, is you didn't say, I mean, as a journalist, I often will read people's writing and think, oh, gosh, I wish I could write like that. And in my head, I often go to, well, I never could. And the fact that you said that, you know, it will take me 10 years, but you actually have a sense of being able to accomplish this, like, even in the face of failure, which I think is so interesting. And I mean, is that something you've always had? Is that again, back to your wiring, or is that something that you've learned over time? Yeah.
It's not at all. In fact, my sense is that my willingness to repeatedly try and fail and shift and grow and run a new experiment over the years, and realize that by doing that hundreds or thousands of times, if I reflect back over a longer term window, then I can see the growth that's led to for me. So for me, like, no, this is not the way that I organically was. You know, when I was a kid and I was painting, I was just like, wow, this sucks. I suck. I'm done. I'm never going to be able to paint Frazetta or all these other, you know, amazing people. And I think, you know, having tried and failed in business, having tried and failed in careers, having tried and failed in, like, all these different domains, and certainly in writing, and then realizing that if I'm not looking at this exact thing that I'm working on, but I'm looking at the arc of what I have been working on over a year or 5 years or 10 years, and I reflect back at what I was capable of creating, you know, in a, over a longer arc, a longer time frame, then I can see my growth, and I can see that, you know, if I stay in it, if I stay in the process, there is real change, and I can see forward movement, you know, and I can see the 1% sort of compound its way into 100%, you know, but it's very hard to see when you have a really narrow time frame where right. you're sort of trying to acknowledge and measure that growth. And right. I think for me, having, you know, I've started probably so many different businesses or projects or ventures or created products so many times that have failed. I've had business things where I've put, you know, like large amounts of money into it, spent a huge amount of time doing it, and then failed, and then come back from it, that I realized that, okay, so that sucked. It was really painful in the moment. I'm not happy that it happened, and yet it made me smarter and stronger and more capable. But no, I was not wired that way when I was younger at all.
It was something you had to learn. And when you do stumble and you fall into that pit of failure, how do you get out of it? How do you personally get yourself to that other place where you're ready to try again?
First, I whine a lot. Oh,
good. We love that. We talk about sitting in the hole of failure and just feeling it and expressing yeah. it and getting it out, not running from yeah. it, not pushing it
no,
away.
No, I don't run from it. Second, I medicate myself with dark chocolate, generally large volumes over a long window of time.
Love it.
And then, you know, I'll try and just sort of like step out of whatever that reality is. And what I found is that, you know, there are two levels of ways to get yourself out of it. One is the effect of a sustained practice, which I have and I'm happy to share it with you. And then there are interventions. You know, the interventions may be a circuit breaker where you have a set of mentors or friends or people that you can sort of like immediately turn to and say, hey, listen, I'm kind of in the middle of my pit of despair. Can you help me?
Yeah.
You know, being willing to be vulnerable and say, this is not working. It didn't. This just went south in a big way. I'm in pain.
Yep.
And I need help. So I think vulnerability, being willing to step into that place yep. And having a small group of people where you can turn to and say, you know, like, I need help yeah. is super important. And I actually have a couple. I mean, I have my wife who I'm actually in business with. And I have a couple of small groups of friends where we actually meet on pretty much a monthly basis and share what's really going on. And we hold ourselves accountable, but we also are there to support each other when things go bad.
Yeah, having that safety and that space to be honest is imperative.
Yeah, no, so agree. So I think on a sort of an intervention level, that's really important. On a sustained practice level, having the ability to cultivate a state of mind that actually allows you to stay in more of a state of equanimity, and instead of falling into, you know, like the bottom of the pit of despair, kind of like dipping into it and realizing mm-hmm. you're there, but knowing that this will pass and knowing that you'll be okay through it and not actually going all the way there has been huge for me. So for me, you know, there are a couple of practices that are absolutely critical. I have a daily mindfulness practice, and I have for years. And that is a practice where it's not an intervention. You know, like if I'm freaking out about something, I don't just sit and then 20 minutes later, I'm like, oh, life is awesome. I'm all better. It doesn't work that way. Mm-hmm. Like so many things, you know, the worst time to sort of start a practice is when you most need it. You know, but
so true.
So it's the type of thing where it's like I do it like washing my hands, you know, or like it's just what I do every day. I wake up first thing in the morning and I have a seated mindfulness practice. And along with that, I also have a breathing practice or pranayama practice, breathing exercises, which came from my experience in yoga, studying and teaching for a lot of years. Mm-hmm. And the geek in me also then went down the science rabbit hole. And mm-hmm. there's some really fascinating science that really shows how closely connected your breathing apparatus is to your nervous system and yes. your ability to actually regulate your flight, fight, and freeze response
yeah.
and your endocrine system along with it. So those practices over time, actually breathing is an intervention. For it's sure. both a sustained practice and an intervention.
Yeah. And so simple.
Yeah.
So simple.
And so so discounted.
Mm-hmm. So true.
You know, my gateway drug to yoga was actually breathing, because I started back when I was a lawyer. And I would, if I had a really adversarial meeting or a court date coming up, I'd freak out. I was shaking in my office and sweating. And I was like, this is not okay. You know, so I started looking for ways to just sort of bring my system back into a calmer state fairly quickly. And I found that certain yogic breathing exercises were super effective at that. So between those two things, over time, the mindfulness practice is fascinating to me because it trains you in three things. One is it trains your attention. So it trains your ability to focus on what you want to focus. It trains your ability to let go of the things that you don't want to be focusing on, which is all the devastating self-talk and, you know, the chatter in your mind, which says you're terrible, this idea is terrible, you're a failure, you'll never come back from this. And it really also, the third thing is it trains you in what I would call open monitoring. It trains you to be more generally aware of what's going on around you and see more clearly the reality of any situation, rather than get stuck in the story that you're telling.
I have a similar a mindfulness practice that I do that's very similar to that. It's called the stop technique, where you stop, take a breath, observe what's going on, and then proceed. And it just stops that story in my mind, if I can be conscious of doing it. And something that's interesting about this is, and I wonder if you found the same kind of the same results in your work. It seems like everyone who kind of deals with failure in a positive way has practices built up in their life that kind of sustain them. Is that something that you found kind of in like your the good life work? Like you kind of have to have practices built up and curiosity to kind of get through these things.
Yeah, for sure. I think you have to have people and practices. You know, to me, anyone who has made a commitment to consistently go to that place where the magic happens, you know, which again is that place where there's a high level of sustained uncertainty and the stakes are increasingly high, you've got to have something. Unless you are one of those rare freaks of nature that just where literally like your brain is wired to love it and be okay. But
and I think there's not many of those. You know, most people, like I think that's an escape we use is like those people are built that way, but a few are built that way. Most people have developed a practice and a habit to get them there in some level.
Completely agree. And this is part of what I researched, you know, with that one book was, you know, and it really, a lot of the people that we hold up as the exemplars are actually this rare, rare, really, 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 really teeny percentage of humanity that are the complete outliers. And then we try and aspire to be them. And we're like, no, that's not going to work. But then a lot of other people aren't those people. A lot of the greatest achievers in all domains actually are not those people. They suffered mightily, but they have built practices and rituals and have the, you know, people in their lives that allow them to be okay. Ritualization is another huge thing that I came across in my research. And what's interesting about rituals is that it's not ritualization of the work. It's ritualization of everything outside of the work. So, for example, there is somebody who I know who is an incredible thinker. And creator, and has founded numerous companies and done incredible creative work and constantly out there just really pushing the envelope and taking risks. And in that space where they're sort of charged with doing that work, they kind of have to be largely untethered. You know, like they're not touching ground most of the time. Mm-hmm. But in every other part of their life, they're hyper-ritualized. So they wear the exact same thing every day. Mm-hmm. They eat the exact same thing every day. They go out and they exercise, they do the same routine at the same time, you know. So, and what I start to realize, I saw that pattern across so many really high level creators that, you know, I realized this is not just some random thing. You know, this is the mind's attempt to drop certainty anchors in enough parts of life so that you feel like you've got places where you can touch stone. Where everything's going to be okay, where there's ground beneath your feet, so that when you go to that place where your job is to not have ground beneath your feet, you're okay going there, you know, and staying there long enough without completely melting down.
Oh, that makes so much sense, and it you can actually visualize it, you know, because I think when things feel so uncertain, you do feel like you're kind of untethered completely. And so to create those rituals, to create that connection and that regularity and predictability. It contains all of that uncertainty and anxiety, which is so important when you're pushing through failure. Because we can't control how long it takes to get through the experience of failure. And yet we want to control when things feel so chaotic. So I think that's an incredible way to conceptualize getting through it.
Yeah. I mean, and plus, if you sort of create this visual, you know, there, uncertainty and possibility are two sides of the same coin. You cannot have possibility without uncertainty. And the greater the possibility, the higher the uncertainty must be. You know, if you want a dime-sized coin of possibility, then you need a dime-sized coin of uncertainty. If you want a silver dollar-sized coin of possibility, you've got to have that same, you know, four times larger size of uncertainty. Right. They are hopelessly and hopefully related. So when we try and make ourselves feel like everything's going to be okay and back off and just search for stability in the name of being able to breathe again, you know, what we're inadvertently doing is at the same time as we back away from uncertainty, we're backing away from possibility without meaning to do that, just because we want to feel better.
Right. Gosh, that's such a good point. And I mean, the one thing that I was thinking about with the ritualization, just getting back to that, and in those moments of uncertainty, I think it's also so important to remember that it can be baby steps. It can be, you know, because it can feel so overwhelming on the whole, and it can just shut you down. And that's where we find that people tend to get stuck in failure. Whereas if you can kind of, envision things in chunks and take it little steps at a time, it can make all the difference.
Oh yeah, huge difference. And that was one of the other patterns that I've seen as well. I'm sure you guys have too, and that actually, you know, has become a fairly big philosophy in software development, agile development. Whereas it, you know, and actually in all forms of business, you know, like the old form, use advertising, for example, you know, the old model was, hey, some company shows up and you say, we need advertising. And they're like, okay, so we're going to put together some TV commercials. We're going to hire a creative team. We need $2 million to produce it and to buy the media time. And we're going to do the whole thing. And then we're going to put it on the air and hope that it works. Massive, crazy risk. And if it doesn't work, somebody gets fired, if not an entire part of a company. Mm. You know, whereas then sort of like the newer approach to creative is, well, no, you know, like we now have the ability with technology to take a much more low stakes iterative approach. Let's really down and dirty, super fast, spend a tiny bit of money to create a handful of videos or tweets or images for Instagram that test some of the ideas that we think might work. And then if we get a positive signal on 10% of that, then we get rid of the 90% that's not working. And then we double down and we start to iterate on the 10% so that it's exactly what you were saying. You know, what we're doing is we're chunking the stakes and we're getting feedback along the way that's validating whether we're right or wrong in much smaller, tiny baby steps. So that by the time we do get to a place where the stakes are genuinely high, what we've done is we've chunked the process of validation, and we've gotten, you know, instead of massive uncertainty in one dose in the beginning, we sort of split it up and had, you know, gone from assumption to validation and to fact in baby steps along the way. And I think you're right, I love seeing that process now sort of starting to be baked into so many different parts of life.
That's amazing. I think about that as a therapist, that I often talk about chunking when you're trying to get through anxiety. Because if you look at the big picture and you think you have to get to the end, it feels so overwhelming. But if you chunk it into small steps, you can manage it and you can be successful. And to take that to business, to take that to relationships, to take that to parenting, right? If we think as parents, oh my God, I have to, you know, grow you into an adult, as opposed to, wait a minute, let's just focus on today or this stage of development. You know, so it makes sense. It's amazing that you're taking these concepts and putting it out into the world in so many different facets.
Yeah, I mean, but if you really think about it, it's if you are going to live a life where you're not just locking yourself into some really tiny box where everything is known, you're going to be in this place where things are uncomfortable. So taking ideas like this and say, okay, so look, I'm not going to completely eliminate this feeling, but there are so many different ways where I can make it, you know, first step tolerable, you know. And second step, I can make not only make it tolerable, but I can feel it and then teach my brain to reframe it as one of you said earlier, like this is actually a signal that what I'm doing matters, and that's actually a good thing.
So yeah, it's what I'm hearing you talk about also is acceptance, because you really come into a situation with an understanding and an acceptance of things being hard and not being easy. And I think that's also so important. And then the reframing, and we talk about that all the time, that taking a situation and reframing it. And I'm wondering, since you lead in, you know, on your website and often in your speeches with being a husband and a father, I'm wondering how this all works for the same way for you in parenting and in your relationship with your family and your wife.
Oh, 100%. I mean, you know, if you go into, you know, trying to be a parent or a partner, you know, with your sole goal being like, I must succeed in my perfect definition of success, you're just screwed from the moment you start.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's just all, you're just setting yourself up, you know, for a complete misery the whole time. Yeah. I think, so I do, you know, like to me, all parts of my life are a series of experiments. And I think a really big shift that we can all make is when we do anything, you know, say, okay, so I would like this to, quote, succeed. I would like the outcome that I'm seeking to happen. But the real leading metric for me in any given moment is learning. So if I switch my metric from success to knowledge acquisition, then I can't ever fail. You know, the only way I fail is if I go through something, you know, expectation and reality don't sync, and then I don't do anything to learn why.
Totally.
You know, but if my metric is like, I want this outcome to happen, it would be awesome. But you know, like my success is if I've learned something, no matter what happens, then it's kind of like you can't fail anymore. As long as you deconstruct, as long as you do a little bit of, okay, so what happened here? So yeah, as a dad, you know, there's no rule book for that. I mean, you know, I look at entrepreneurship as a profound and sometimes diabolical canvas to develop the human being. Parenting, you know, like amplifies that 1,000 times.
Right, right.
You know, there is no, I mean, it's just every day is new and beautiful and wondrous and calamitous and amazing. And you know, you're just kind of going along with the flow to a certain extent. And I think really important is also understanding that whatever expectations and outcomes you have in your mind are yours and not your kids. And your job is to kind of step back and allow your kid the space to breathe and to fail and to try and to learn and to iterate and to feel, you know, whatever goes along with that, and shield them, you know, or at least do your best to shield them from the really big, seriously, you know, like life-threatening or dangerous stuff. But the day-to-day stuff where, you know, there's an opportunity to stumble, to create the practice in you to allow that to happen so that they can learn through their own experience, and then so that they can come back and try again and then do these things. And when they finally have the outcome that they want, they can feel the esteem and the confidence, not because you fixed it for them or not because you protected them from like the whole situation, but because they figured it out themselves.
Yeah.
And there's nothing like that feeling. I mean, as an adult, there's nothing like that feeling.
I love that so much, because I think that's, and I think that kind of deals with your whole idea of switching that switch from, you know, success to learning. Because I think right now, you know, we talk a lot on this podcast that parents really won't let their kids fail, or there's such a thing to be the perfect kid or the perfect parent. And I love that you're talking about creating that space, because it's giving them the skills to be successful in life, ultimately.
Yeah. And by the way, I'm you know, I say it like it's just a matter of fact, like any parent knows, it's brutally hard to do that.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't claim in any way, shape or form to, you know, say, well, I always succeed at it. But I do try to create that space. I mean, I have, my daughter and I are snowboarders. And there's a lot of, you get beat up in the early days of snowboarding, and there's a lot of failure, and there's a growth curve that goes along with that. And, you know, and I've been snowboarding for a lot of years, and my daughter for a lot fewer, just because she's, you know, younger. And And I remember in the beginning, you know, wanting to just sort of like trying to figure out how to shortcut the learning process for her, but also knowing that, you know, she's kind of got to go through a process. And we're at a point now where I'm 53 and I'm kind of pulling back and slowing down a little bit on the snowboard. And you know, like she's at an age where she's going faster.
Right.
And we're going these two directions where we're sort of a similar skill level. So now we go out on the mountain and we just cruise side by side. And there's like, there's a beauty and a grace and a confidence in the way that I see her on the mountain now, which never would have happened had I tried to protect her from every fall and every stumble and sort of like teach her, you know, like leapfrog her past all of that other stuff. And also like part of that grace and joy comes from the fact, not that she's become good at it, but that she figured it out.
Yeah. I think what's so incredible about you is your ability to articulate all of that messy stuff in the middle, that it's not just setting a goal and then achieving it, that you really articulate the struggle and the pain and the difficulty about the process and that scaffolding of how do you get to that place where you're cruising the mountain. Because again, I think so many people forget that you're actually supposed to fall. You're actually supposed to bleed a little in order to get to that place of cruising.
Yeah. And it's the stumbles that imbue the outcome with value.
Oh, you have such good little quotes. You should definitely write, for sure.
Nah. I suck at a write.
Talking.
But it's true, because it's like if you think about it, you know, if somebody showed you, like just showed up and they're like, okay, so I'm going to give you everything you ever wanted.
Yeah.
And your first reaction would be like, sweet.
Right.
I'm shortcutting the whole thing.
Right.
And then you get it. And this, like, this is the, you know, like the research, which shows we habituate ridiculously quickly to all circumstance. Mm-hmm. You know, the thing that actually gives something meaning is the fact that is the journey that you've taken to get there. You know, if you just got it, if it was handed over to you, we think that that's what we want, but it's not, because we get the thing, but it doesn't have meaning because, you know, we haven't actually gone through the process that would give it meaning to get it.
I'm wondering, just to kind of finish things off, if you can talk a little bit about what, you know, where you see yourself going with the Good Life Project and, you know, what your thoughts are and, down the road, what your plans are.
Yeah. Over the last year, basically, I have been in my maker cave developing a whole new body of work, to identify or to create tools and programs that help people identify what I would call it the source code for work that fills them with a sense of meaning and purpose, allows them to feel fully expressed and in flow in their world. And that's a lot of where my work is going right now. We actually did a lot of the background research last year and spent most of the year building the first tool, which is an assessment that sort of allows people to answer a whole bunch of different questions and then be assigned one of a set of archetypes, actually two, sort of primary and secondary archetype, that just give them a really powerful starting point from, you know, it's not the type of thing that says, hey, you should be a lawyer or a doctor. It's the type of thing that says the deeper sort of DNA level drivers underneath all of this is this. And if you can, you know, express that in 1,000 different ways and 1,000 different jobs and 1,000 different industries, it gives you a ton of freedom to understand what to really look for.
Right.
Those archetypes are actually called sparkotypes, which is kind of a fun way of just saying it's the archetype that sparks you.
Cool.
And we made the assessment, you know, completely free online for anybody to take and fill out.
Well, you're doing so much, and it's such a gift to the world, because we're all looking to figure out how to put these ideas into action. And I think that's, you know, something you do so beautifully is make this possible for everybody. Doesn't matter your background or what you have or don't have. It's all very accessible. So,
yeah, I again agree. And I think one of the cool things is, you know, earlier when you were talking about how you weren't built certain ways and, you know, there's the uncertainty we face. And you mentioned Joseph Campbell, and the whole time you were talking, it made me think of a Joseph Campbell quote I really love, saying, and I believe, if I get it right, the cave you fear holds the treasure you seek. And I feel like that's what you do, is you kind of give people this the material to kind of enter that cave, you know, and that's very cool. And we so appreciate it.
Yeah, that's definitely part of my own personal journey. And to the extent that I can create tools that help me and then share that, that's definitely one of the things that I enjoy doing. So thank you.
Absolutely. Where can people find these tools? Obviously the podcast. Is there a website you want to send people to specifically?
Yeah, I mean, if you just go to goodlifeproject.com or sparkatype.com, that's spark, the letter E, and type.com.
Awesome. Jonathan, thank you so much, man. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Other F Word Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review our podcast, and visit us online at theotherfwordpodcast.com. You can also find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. And we'd love to hear your stories of struggle with failure. You can contact us at info@theotherfwordpodcast.com. See you next time.